content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll be reading an article titled Exploring the Lost Treasures of Pisidia by Joshua Hammer. In southern Turkey, an extensive new trail network spirits trekkers to a crossroads of ancient civilizations. We set off along the trail through the Azili Canyon on a warm October morning, ascending through the foothills of the Taurus Mountains, north of the Turkish coastal city of Antalya. Clusters of pines and gnarled olive trees clung to the walls of the gorge, and lichen-covered boulders blocked stretches of the footpath. 100 feet below, the icy Aksu River, known in ancient times as Kestros, coursed toward the Mediterranean Sea. To the north rose the Taurus Range, ascending to 12,000 feet, with pine-cloaked hills receding into ridges enveloped in a bluish haze. Lutgard van de Put, the Belgian director of the British Institute at Ankara, BIAA, which had helped organize this trek, paused before an empty niche carved into the natural limestone wall of the canyon. 2 millenniums ago, such alcoves were common along the roads of Pisidia, a remote and wild region of Anatolia, the Asian part of modern-day Turkey. In antiquity, niches typically contained a statue of a deity such as Apollo, the son of Zeus and the god of agriculture, arts, and healing, where travelers could offer libations and ask for protection from wild animals and warring tribes. A crumbling inscription of Greek caught my eye. I picked out patrios, literally of one's father or countryman, and phobos, fear. As control over the mountains changed hands through the centuries, Christian saints replaced the Hellenistic Roman deity. But now the remnants of that millenniums-old history are endangered of being damaged or even lost. Van de Put, a trim woman with short-cropped reddish hair, wired-rimmed spectacles, and an energetic demeanor, gestured to a gaping hole gouged beside the niche. "People think these shrines mark locations where gold is stored," she said. "They chisel into the rock and see what's behind it. Sometimes they use dynamite." For 3 days, I had been walking across the Taurus Massif with a dozen other hikers from the United States, the United Kingdom, and Turkey. We are one of the first international groups to explore the Pisidia Heritage Trail, a roughly 215-mile network of footpaths, along with a few crumbling miles of paved Roman highways, connecting the ruins of more than a half a dozen ancient towns that had once flourished in this corner of Asia Minor. Until recently, few tourists bothered to visit the region, discouraged by its remoteness and lack of infrastructure. The idea to stitch it all together had its origins in the 1980s, with the work of Stephen Mitchell, a longtime archaeologist with the BIAA, the Venerable Institute founded in 1947. Mitchell spent 15 years conducting surveys of 7 ancient settlements here, hacking through forgotten ruins in the mountains, identifying the architecture, and opening Pisidia to the world. Despite the ancient reputation of Pisidians as uncivilized and barbarians, the Greek historian Strabo wrote that they were trained in piracy, Mitchell found evidence of a prosperous and cultured people with a high level of social and civic organization, shaped by a succession of conquerors. In 2013, a Turkish archaeologist named Izile Gursu, working with the BIAA, proposed linking the sites and a few other ancient cities surveyed by Turkish, British, Belgian, and Austrian archaeologists. She and her colleagues had hoped that an influx of visitors would inject cash into the region and help stem the persistent looting of antiquities. "Every time Stephen and I came back, we would see illicit digging," Van de Put says. We thought if we could find a way to provide villagers with an income, it might encourage them to protect the heritage that remains. In cooperation with the Turkish government, the IAA put up signposts, and it produced a guidebook and designed an app, thanks to the spread of 4G and LTE cellular technology in rural Turkey, allows visitors to visualize on-site what the ruined structures would have looked like in their heyday. The first tours, organized by BIAA and a Turkish company called Equinox Travel, began in 2018, but the COVID-19 pandemic derailed the project for 3 years. Recently, the tours started again. The group I was trekking with reflected the project's embryonic nature. All had learned about the Pisidia Heritage Trail through word of mouth. They included a top American diplomat in Ankara, who was accompanied by 4 Turkish bodyguards, the second in command at the British embassy, a Turkish-speaking British expatriate who had retired to a village near Hisarlik, the site of ancient Troy, the city of Homer's Iliad near the Dardanelles, a Cambridge classicist and archaeologist who specialized in Byzantine-era sites, and a young Turkish art dealer from Istanbul. Because of the absence of camping facilities, a van met us at the end of each day, shuttling us to inns and dinners and overnights, and drove us to a new trailhead the next morning. The American diplomat traveled separately in a Toyota Land Cruiser escorted by 2 backup vehicles. A little farther down the path from the niche in the limestone wall, I came upon a plaque installed by Turkish authorities that helped to locate this remote route in a broad sweep of history. Around AD 48, a date approximated by biblical historians, Paul the Apostle sailed from Cyprus to Anatolia. Joined by the Cypriot named Barnabas, the evangelist set forth to preach the gospel to the Jews and Gentiles of Pisidia, who had fallen under the control of the Roman Empire. Some historians believe that they followed the very path we were walking, dubbed by Turkish officials St. Paul's Way. Other scholars contend that Paul would have likely followed a safer route, the Via Sebaste, a Roman-built paved road that could handle chariots and skirted the mountainous terrain. Eventually, Paul and Barnabas arrived in the Pisidian city of Antioch, the largest in the region with a population of 50,000. On the day of worship, they went into a synagogue and sat down, according to Acts 13:14-15. After the law of Moses and the writings of the prophets were read, the synagogue's leaders asked Paul and Barnabas whether they had any words to encourage the people. Paul rose and, motioning with his hand, began a sermon about salvation through faith and God's grace, and not by good deeds alone, he said. Men of Israel and you who fear God, listen. But the elders rejected Paul's teachings and expelled him and Barnabas from Pisidia. Christianity would take root here, but not for another 350 years. The Taurus mountain range runs in an east-west arc for hundreds of miles, separating the Mediterranean coast from the Anatolian plateau. For thousands of years, it was home to feuding tribes who called themselves the Luwians, according to cuneiform tablets found in the archives of the 14th century BC Hittite Empire, rulers of Anatolia. When Alexander the Great passed through this rugged terrain in 334 BC, after crossing the Dardanelles, he confronted well-defended mountain enclaves nominally controlled by Persia's Achaemenid Empire. His first step in the territory the Greeks called Pisidia was Termessos, on the verdant slopes of the 5,000-foot-high Gulak Mountain. The town was a very lofty place, precipitous on every side, wrote Arian of Nicomedia, who early in the 2nd century AD compiled a 7-volume chronicle of Alexander's military campaigns. Despairing of being able to capture it, Alexander bypassed the city and marched north. Next, he reached Sagalassos, the most fearsome settlement in the region. Alexander led his armored warriors up the hill, fending off a hail of arrows. 500 Pisidians and an untold number of Macedonians were killed. Arian wrote before Alexander, quote, took their city by storm, end quote. After Alexander's death, his generals divided up the territory. Greek became the lingua franca. Civic structures such as the Bulletarion, a meeting place for the Council of Elders, took root in every polis, the Greek term for city-state. Stephen Mitchell, whom I met in a Berlin cafe last November, just after I returned from my trip, explained that cities captured by Alexander became a mixture of Macedonian settlers and indigenous people who intermarried. Mitchell died in January at age 75. Yet Pisidia's cities were left to run themselves, and civil wars between the city-states continued as they had before Hellenization. The Seleucid Empire, founded by one of Alexander's generals, took control of the region in the late 4th century and ruled until its collapse 250 years later, continuing to imprint Greek culture on the ever-feuding tribes. Everything changed under the Pax Romana, a period of relative stability ushered in by Emperor Augustus around 31 BC. The Romans stationed garrisons in Kremna, Anatolia, Pergae, and Termessos. They built a network of paved roads, restyled Hellenistic buildings, and constructed theaters for dramas and gladiatorial combat. They also appointed a governor in every city-state. Farming and trade flourished. Antioch and Pisidia became a colony for Roman war veterans. As at other such colonies throughout Asia Minor and Syria, founded to project Roman power, the soldiers received small agricultural plots from state landholdings and were expected to suppress uprisings and secure the territory. When Strabo traveled through Pisidia in the 1st century AD, he was struck by its abundance. Among the summits of the Taurus, there is a country which can support tens of thousands of inhabitants, he wrote, and is so very fertile that it is planted with olive in many places and with fine vineyards, and produces abundant pasture for cattle of all kinds, and above this country all around it lie forests of various kinds of timber. One morning, in our van, we inched our way up the side of a mountain to 3,000 feet above the coastal plain to Ariassos, sprawling across arid Mediterranean hills. Umit Eason, Equinox's founder and our guide, a burly man in his 50s with a cheerful manner and an engaging speaking style, peered over the ridge. Living down there was always risky, he said. The mountains would have offered protection from invasion. The first modern European explorer to visit this site was an aristocratic Pole named Karol Lanarowski. He called it Kratopolis, a misnomer stemming from his belief that its ancient inhabitants came from the Greek island of Crete. Lakaronski sketched a tomb and other structures for his classic 1890 survey, The Cities of Pamphylia and Pisidia. In 1892, a French expedition found inscriptions that named the city as Ariassos. Then it was ignored for another century, until Mitchell and a team arrived in 1988. Mitchell's Pisidia survey project mapped the city, identified buildings, and traced its development over a millennium. You see a lot of stuff piled on the ground, and you've got to make sense of it, Mitchell told me over cappuccinos in Berlin. It's a giant three-dimensional jigsaw puzzle. You put together the pieces. Now Eason was standing in front of an Ariassos' most striking feature, a 36-foot-tall limestone arch erected more than 1,800 years ago in a saddle between scrub-covered and boulder-strewn hills. Mitchell, who specialized in epigraphy, had found an inscription indicating that a local citizen, Domitius Samos, erected it to commemorate a Roman victory in the Persian Wars in AD 233. Businessmen in the boondocks often flattered their Roman overlords by financing expensive monuments, Eason said. The arch was built in the style of Hadrian's Gate in Anatolia, an ornate series of coronated vaults built in AD 130 to honor the emperor's visit to the city. Here, three simple archways supported four plinths that would have displayed statues of Severus Alexander, the reigning emperor, and three predecessors, Septimius Severus, Caracalla, and Julia Domna. It was far more modest than its Anatolia counterpart, yet it would have been an ostentatious display in this remote outpost. Climbing a hill above the Victory Arch, we passed sarcophagi emblazoned with an ancient sword and shield emblem that we would encounter everywhere in Pisidia. The motif was opted by the British Institute at Ankara as the trail marker and is painted on trees and rocks along the route. Eason pointed out the remains of Ariassos' Boulatarion. All that was left was a scattering of stones and fragmentary walls on a plateau with commanding views of the plain. Like many Greek polis, the city minted its own currency. In 1967, Turkish authorities seized 209 bronze coins bearing markings from Ariosos, which had turned up at Istanbul's Grand Bazaar after they were sold illegally to an antiques dealer. A four-hour hike through scrub-pine forests and over fields of jagged limestone brought us to the ruins of Sia, scattered on the southern and western slopes of a wooded hill 12 miles east of Ariosos. Founded during the Hellenistic period, it otherwise remains a mystery. All the ancient sources are silent about Sia, as if it never existed, Eisen said. Arian and other historians talk about wars, roads, and trade in Pisidia, but not one mentions this name. Yet Sia undoubtedly grew into an important polis. Immense blocks of stone from Hellenistic and Roman structures were strewn across the forest floor, possibly toppled by an earthquake, and several intact walls rose around them. These finely cut blocks, which fit snugly together, were classic examples of ancient drywall masonry, but where Greeks usually cut building stones on site to fit a particular space, the Romans standardized stone size and formats. Four lintels that once bore statues of Roman emperors adorned a stone-roofed hut. It was a temple of the imperial cult, likely dedicated to rulers such as Augustus and Nero, who were believed to be invested with divine authority. An inscription on the lintel was written in Greek. Latin was barely used in Western Anatolia during Roman times, except in garrison towns and veterans' colonies. Ho demos ho sinoi, it reads, the people of Sia. It is the only evidence that exists of the city's name. A short walk from the temple stood a large reclined structure. BIAA surveyors identified a semicircular protrusion as an apse and concluded that the building had been one of Pisidia's earliest churches, a three-aisle basilica constructed in the late 4th century. The Roman Emperor Constantine legalized Christianity in AD 313, and for seven decades, the new faith and age-old paganism existed side by side. Theodosius, an able military leader from Iberia, who was chosen to rule the besieged Roman Empire following the destruction of its legions by the Goths, made Christianity the state religion in AD 380, and later outlawed paganism altogether. The remains of two other churches lay near this basilica, evidence that Sia had grown into an important center of faith during the last days of Rome and the dawn of the Byzantine Empire. The center of Christian life in the region, however, became Antioch in Pisidia, a city whose Jewish leaders chased out Paul the Apostle when he arrived to convert the population. Archaeologists recently unearthed a Byzantine church there, and at the same excavation site, a ruin that may have been a very synagogue in which Paul preached two millenniums ago. The indefatigable evangelist returned there twice and received an equally unfriendly reception on each visit. 2 Timothy speaks of his persecutions and sufferings. Around the 4th century AD, Antioch served as an early church diocese, a center of evangelization whose influence spread across the mountains. Another morning, as our driver, a gray-bearded, sunburned, tough-looking Turk named Mehmet Yaman, navigated our van up the switchbacks toward the trailhead. Vandeput evoked a picture of the region from its Roman-era heyday. There would have been fields of walnuts, wine grapes, and olive groves, she told us. The landscape would have been terraced and completely used for agriculture, with villages, rural estates, and systems of roads built to keep the military supplied and moved around. Modern Pisidia has turned back to wilderness. For the next 3 days, we trekked through landscapes in which people were conspicuously absent. We ascended to a verdant plateau marked by hundreds of natural pillars that have been thrust straight upward, like the ancient Moai statues of Easter Island, by the tectonic movement of the Taurus Range. We scrambled up three slopes so precipitous that they often required handholds, letting loose mini avalanches of pebbles on the hikers below. We followed a mile-long stretch of a Roman road that paralleled the Kropruke River, known in antiquity as the Eurymedon River, a remarkably preserved highway of limestone blocks that curved through a canyon toward the Mediterranean. The trail abounded with pink and purple wildflowers, lemon trees, thyme, oregano, and myrrh. One afternoon beside the river, we came upon a distinctive shrub with pink petals. Eisen recognized the plant as the poisonous oleander, which contains a chemical compound that, when ingested, can cause vomiting, nausea, cardiac arrhythmia, low blood pressure, even death. It was said that some of Alexander's troops perished after using oleander skewers to cook their meat. Eat the root of the oleander and die, reads an old Turkish curse. Our own diets were less risky. Breakfasts at the rural inns where we spent the night consisted of generous spreads of olives, hummus, cheeses, fig jam, honey, hard-boiled eggs, tea, and strong, bitter Turkish coffee. Lunch was typically lahmacun, a Turkish flatbread topped with minced meat, minced vegetables, and herbs. Baked in one establishment, we stopped at an open fire in a rear courtyard. In the evenings, after a long day in the mountains, we gathered around communal tables for lamb or chicken kebabs or grilled tout fished out of the Kapruke River, followed by glasses of raki, the Turkish national drink, made from aniseed and twice distilled grapes. Accommodations were spare, rustic, yet comfortable. One morning, I woke at dawn to a persistent racket on my cottage porch. Three sheep were butting heads and upending the furniture. They scampered off when I tore open the curtains and shooed them away. They came back minutes later and resumed their mischief. One afternoon, toward the ends of the trek, we headed for the ruins of a place called Selga. A steep 2-hour climb brought us to a crest that provided panoramic views of the two Taurus valleys. Thickly forested slopes, giving way to ridgeline after ridgeline, receding into the distance. We paused to eat trail mix and dried apricots in the sun as two griffin vultures rode thermals overhead. These large raptors were among the few birds we encountered during 5 days in the mountains. Poaching is said to be rampant here. Then we followed a series of sharp descents and ascents into the ancient city. The region around the city and the territory of the Selgians has only a few approaches, Strabo wrote, since their territory is mountainous and full of precipices and ravines. As a result, the historian went on, the Selgians had never even once become subject to others, but unmolested have reaped the fruit of the whole country. Through ancient historians say that Selga would wield a formidable fighting force. The city's sovereignty ended in 25 BC when it surrendered to the Romans, who incorporated Selga into the province of Galatia. Afterwards, Selga provided timber for Roman shipbuilding, floating logs down the river to the Mediterranean port of Aspendos. A city, minting in its own money, grew to become one of the most important cities in Pisidia. The power that the Selgians once exerted was instantly apparent as we hiked through the ruins. At 3,000 feet above sea level, the ruins cover a sweep of fertile hills dominated by an acropolis called Kesbedion. An Austrian team not related to the BIAA conducted an archaeological survey here in 1981. Pieces of engraved columns and limestone slabs were all that remained of the Temple of Zeus. From the acropolis, we descended to the main part of the city, where about 20,000 people once lived. A 20-foot-high intact wall, it neatly fitted stone slabs perforated by an archway, bordered a still-paved agora or marketplace. In the valley below, fortuitously illuminated by a rainbow, loomed Selga's outdoor theater, with a capacity of 9,000 people, one of the largest in the region. Gladiatorial combat took place here, as well as plays and mock naval battles. As we perched on a stone bench 50 feet above the theater floor, local women selling keychains, scarves, and other knickknacks surrounded us. It was the first and only commercial activity at the ancient sites we encountered during the nearly a week in Pisidia. Indeed, except for a handful of sites such as Selga, Pisidia remains so little explored that even Mitchell was sometimes surprised by what turns up here. In September 2023, he embarked on an 8-day hike on the Pisidia Heritage Trail with a dozen family members. Outside a cafe near Sagalassos, Mitchell came upon a slab with a 25-line inscription using ancient Greek script. Retired archaeologist and epigrapher realized that he was looking at a language he didn't recognize. I didn't understand a word, he told me. The inscription, he determined, was written in a long-extinct Pisidian dialect. In fact, it was the longest inscription known to exist in the native tongue of the western Anatolian mountains. We put out the words on social media, Mitchell told me. 2 days later, Turkey's Ministry of Culture and Tourism descended on the cafe and took away the slab. Today it sits in the garden of the Isparta Museum. According to Vandeput, there are so few scholars working in ancient Pisidian languages that the inscription may never be deciphered. And thus crucial details about their wars, gods, and other aspects of Pisidian life will likely never be known. Selgus citizens embraced Christianity in the late 4th century, and the city endured for 200 more years. Then, like its neighbors, the once thriving metropolis ceased to exist. We found very little evidence for new buildings or for anything else that would indicate activities after AD 600, Mitchell told me. All of Pisidia comes to a rude full stop. 7th century Islamic conquerors and possibly outbreaks of the plague drove the population down to the plain. Temblors and the passage of time toppled the Hellenistic and Roman structures. Forests rose around them. The structures themselves sank into obscurity. Now, thanks to Mitchell, Vandeput, Eisen, and his Turkish colleagues, they are slowly emerging again. Now we'll read a quick article in the prologue section called Classical Talent by Amy Crawford. A new show illuminates the success of a Caribbean-born painter in Paris. Born to a formerly enslaved mother in Guadeloupe, Guillaume Lettier, 1760 to 1832, moved to Paris as a teen with his plantation owner father and launched his artistic career during the tumultuous years before the French Revolution. Lettier's talent as a painter of portraits of the rich and famous, landscapes, and scenes from history won him plum academic posts and a place at the center of Creole society. But in the two centuries after his death, the neoclassicist has faded into relative obscurity. That's set to change in June with the world's first ever Lettier retrospective at Massachusetts' Clark Art Institute. The show aims not to just rehabilitate Lettier as an artist, but also to tell the story of his remarkable life. He lived in an age of drastic shifts in politics and painterly style, says Esther Bell, the Clark's chief curator. We want people to learn about him as a gifted, ambitious talent, but also what it meant to be of mixed race from the Caribbean living in France at the time. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.